Well, thank you so much, Judith, and good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for coming. And you're probably all wondering what all these cards are doing out on the tables, and I'll explain that to you in a little bit. So what I'd like to do is just begin by reading you a poem. It's by, the poet is David Wagoner, and the poem is called Lost. Stand still. The trees ahead and the bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen. It answers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again, saying, here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, you're surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. So I'm honored to be here, and I'm delighted that Judith asked me to sort of respond to the theme of the particular chapter that she asked me to look at in The Universal Christ by Richard Rohr called A Sacred Wholeness, because it really speaks to something that's kind of very close to my heart, as I'll be sharing with you, and that's the whole mystery of healing, what we mean by healing, or wholeness, a sacred wholeness. And what I thought I'd do is I'd like to start by just responding. I've read the chapter a few times, and there are particular points in the chapter that really touch me, and that I'd like to just comment on. So I'd like to begin by doing that. And then I'd like to, I'm going to ask you just to participate in a very brief little introductory exercise. Then I'm going to share a little bit more about my own journey, my own healing journey, or journey into understanding what healing is all about, as best one can. And then we're going to come to another experiential exercise that's going to involve the cards. That's actually quite a lot of fun. People who've done it before tell me, and actually, I think quite a lovely exercise. So, those of you who have read this chapter, A Sacred Wholeness, I believe it's chapter 6, but will know that Richard Rohr, he sort of focuses on two people in that chapter and their thinking, and one is the young Jewish woman, Etty Hillesum, who was imprisoned by the Nazis during the Second World War and who died in Auschwitz. And Richard Rohr writes about Etty Hillesum. He says, as the Nazis began their campaign of genocide and Etty's future became more and more uncertain, she addressed God repeatedly in her diaries, regarding him not as an external savior, but as a power she could feed and nurture within herself. And this inner voice, what Richard Rohr refers to as the voice of the universal Christ, is, it seems to be, a core theme of this particular chapter, A Sacred Wholeness. And he goes on and comments, he says, Etty Hillesum is but one example of another function of the Christ, a universally available voice that calls all things to become whole and true to themselves. So really, her journey was one of hearing and listening and responding to this inner voice, and in the process becoming more whole. She goes on, and this is from her own diary, from Etty's diary, she writes, in spite of everything, and it's important to note, she wrote this while she was in a concentration camp, while she's in Westerbork concentration camp, days before she was sent to Auschwitz. She says, in spite of everything, you always end up with the same conviction. Life is good, after all. It's not God's fault that things go awry sometimes. That's what stays with me, even now, even when I'm about to be packed off to Poland with my whole family. So those words coming from anybody else might be hard to take, especially if one is living through a harder time in one's own life or watching a loved one go through a hard time in their life. But hearing that coming from somebody who's literally sitting in the darkness of a concentration camp, being able to talk with conviction that life is good after all. I know there's another chapter in the book, The Universe of Christ, where Richard Rohr talks about, I'm not sure if he calls it original blessing, but it's a similar idea. And, you know, hearing her talking like this and seeing, you know, kind of noting that, it reminds me of a definition of health that comes from the Tibetan tradition, Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa. He says, although the usual dictionary definition of health is, roughly speaking, free from sickness, that's how a lot of us understand what health is, he goes on and he says, we should look at health as something more than that. According to the Buddhist tradition, people inherently possess Buddha nature. That is, they're basically and intrinsically good. That at the core of our being, the core of everyone's being, there's original goodness, or the universal Christ, or Buddha nature, however one calls it. From this point of view, health is intrinsic. That is, health comes first. Sickness is secondary. Health is our basic state, is our deepest state. Etty goes on and says, these 2 months behind barbed wire have been the two richest and most intense months of my life, in which my highest values have been so deeply confirmed. I've learned to love Westerbork. Westerbork was the concentration camp she was in before going to Auschwitz in Poland. Another concentration camp survivor who wrote an incredible book, some of you may know, is the Austrian psychiatrist Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl wrote a book after he emerged from the experience of the concentration camps and losing most of his family in the process. He wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And in Man's Search for Meaning, he writes, the last of human freedoms is our ability to choose our response in any given set of circumstances. So we may find ourselves in the dark night of the soul or the dark night of a concentration camp, but we still have choices as to where we pay attention, what we attend to, what we prioritize. So I'd like to read you... this is a friend of mine. His name is Balfour Mount. He's a doctor in Canada, professor of palliative care. He's actually the person who came up with the phrase palliative care. In that sense, he invented palliative care, and he started the very first team in the world in palliative care at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal. And he talks here about, you know, that it is possible to die healed. It is possible to die healed. It is possible to die in wholeness, which might seem very counterintuitive or just not make a whole lot of sense, because how can we talk about healing in the face of, you know, the body's weakening and the body's demise? But he tells this short little anecdote just to illustrate what he means. He's talking about a young patient of his called Chip. And He's met Chip many years previously, but still often talks about him because he was deeply touched by him and by his story. He says, "I feel Chip's presence, I often do, although decades have passed since we last talked. Just before his death, he said to me, 'You know, Bal, this last year has been the best year of my life.' Those months had been agonizing for those of us who cared for Chip. We'd been helpless as the apparent triumph of surgery and chemotherapy melted before our eyes. The physical magnificence of this gracious, world-class athlete and businessman had been reduced to a grotesque parody of his former impressive presence. The best year of that life? Chip explained that he had found himself on an unexpected journey inward. It was that voyage, he said, that had filled his dying with wonder and peace." He was 30 years old. So there's something here, too. I think there's something in that story about healing. There's something about original goodness and our Buddha nature, our original health. But there's also something about the healing power of gratitude. You know, coming back to Viktor Frankl's quote, "We always have a choice, no matter what our circumstances that we don't have control over, we still have a choice as to what we pay attention to." And so one of the choices we have is to look at the glass, even if it's 1/100th full, and pay attention to the 1/100th. Many of us, as you know, will look at the 1/100th that is empty and miss even the rest of fullness that is there. Richard Rohr goes on and says, "God's two main tools in this direction, in the direction of healing, from every appearance, seem to be great love and great suffering. God seems to send us on the path towards wholeness, not by eliminating obstacles, but by making use of them." And so there's the paradox here, which I think is a very central and familiar paradox, you know, to those for whom the Christian story resonates. And that is that suffering can be a portal to healing. The crucifixion can lead to the resurrection. In fact, the crucifixion is the only way to the resurrection. An early Celtic saint who was a contemporary of St. Patrick's in Ireland wrote, "May you have the commitment to know what's hurt you, to allow it come closer to you, and in the end, to become one with you. May you have the commitment to know what's hurt you, to allow it come closer to you, and in the end, to become one with you." And contemporary saint who recently passed away, Leonard Cohen, in his song Anthem, you may be familiar, he says, "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. It's not about perfection. Healing has nothing to do with perfection. There's a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in. There's a crack in everything." So then, in the second part of the chapter, Richard Rohr goes and focuses a little bit more on Jung, Carl Jung, the great psychologist Carl Jung, and looks at how he talked about the central move in the healing journey, as he understood it and articulated it, was a movement from a life that's oriented around the ego, which is like the self with a little s, the sort of part of the part of us that controls, and it's the executive function. It's an important part of our psychological makeup, but it's power hungry. And it likes to be in total control of things. And Jung saw the midlife crisis as an internal struggle where somebody is moving, being invited to move from a life that's still oriented around the ego, around establishing kind of survival and caring for one's family and making one's place in the world, to the second half of life, which he saw a move towards a life oriented around the self with a capital S. And he also referred to the self with a capital S as the God archetype, or the God within. So Richard Rohr, talking about this, says, the God archetype is the part of you that drives you towards greater inclusivity by deep acceptance of the real, the balancing of opposites, simple compassion towards oneself, and the ability to recognize and forgive your own shadow side. For Jung, wholeness was not to be confused with any kind of supposed moral perfection. So it's kind of the idea of wholeness as a widening circle of awareness, or a widening circle of consciousness that more and more of who we are gets included in. So we become more and more diversely ourselves as our life unfolds. I'd like to read a poem that speaks to this. It's a poem by the German, or by the Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke, called Widening Circles. I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. I circle around God, around the primordial tower. I've been circling for thousands of years. And I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? So healing as widening circles of compassion and inclusivity. Richard Rohr writes, both Etty Hillesum and Carl Jung trusted in and hearkened to the voice of God in their deepest selves. Question this brings up that Richard Rohr comments on is, you know, how can we trust this inner voice? How can we know that it really is a voice that's coming from God, coming from ultimate goodness, rather than from the little self in disguise? You know, the ego is pretty crafty and can come around in all kinds of ways. So how can it be trusted? When I was living in London and working at St. Christopher's Hospice with Dame Cicely Saunders and her team, I was there for 10 years. But during that time, part of my journey into healing was actually studying at a place called Heathrop College, which was run by, by the Jesuits. It was a Jesuit college. And they were teaching Ignatian spiritual direction, and I did a year's training with them at that time. And that was one of the phrases that I remember from that training was what they call the discernment of spirits, of kind of those of you that are familiar with Ignatian spiritual direction will know that it's very inner-based. It's very much about kind of noticing the moves in one's heart and spirit, and discerning which of those to listen to and which of those to trust. And really the kind of ultimate touchstone was, does this voice lead in the direction of peace of heart, compassion, forgiveness, care of the most vulnerable, acts of kindness? So in other words, William James, the great American psychologist, he was asked at the end of his... He wrote this book called Varieties of Religious Experience. Some of you may have come across it, where he talks about all the different types of spiritual and religious experience. And somebody asked him in an interview afterwards, well, how do you really trust a particular path? And he just replied, by their fruits you shall know them. And that really is ultimately the touchstone. Does this inner voice lead not just to my experiencing deep inner peace, but enhance my sense of compassion, my desire to include others in my caring, especially the most vulnerable, acts of kindness. Richard Rohr comments on another way of discerning if what one is experiencing is coming from the universal Christ or that God archetype within. He says, if something comes towards you with grace and can pass through you and towards others with grace, you can trust it as the voice of God. It takes much courage and humility to trust the voice of God within. Mary, as in Our Lady, fully personifies such trust in her momentous and free "Let it be" to the Archangel Gabriel. And there's something in this that also speaks to me of a different theme, and we're kind of doing a kind of a circle around sacred wholeness here, some of the different aspects of it. But here's another aspect of wholeness that is touched on in Mary's "Let It Be," where, and that is the transformative and healing power of radical receptivity. I'd like to read you just a short little passage from, this is from The Nest in the Stream. "The Nest in the Stream speaks to me of a way of being that is deeply receptive. Our hearts pump, but only after they've opened their atria wide to receive the body's blood. Receptivity is neither a feminine nor a masculine quality. It's how our heart is in its most relaxed state. Our hearts are designed to receive before they pump, and our lives depend on this happening. It's important to distinguish between receptivity and passivity. Passivity suggests defeat and may have negative connotations, especially for those who've been on the receiving end of abusive power relationships. Receptivity, on the other hand, implies a conscious choice, choosing an attitude of receptivity, choosing to open our hearts wide and to keep them open, even in the face of suffering, is a courageous and powerful way of meeting the world." Irish philosopher and poet John Moriarty speaks eloquently about this. He describes this stance as a new kind of heroism. He says, "A hero like Cú Chulainn was a bit like Hercules, kind of a great Irish hero who went out and battled the waves and so on. A hero like Cú Chulainn isn't what we need. We need another kind of hero altogether. The hero now isn't someone who goes out and fights the sea. The hero now isn't somebody who wields a sword. It's someone who puts down his sword and lets nature happen to him. This kind of hero is one who faces life with an open and receptive heart." In watching The Nest in the Stream, I began to understand the relationship between receptivity and compassionate action. As the heart opens, receives, and swells before it pumps, so the impulse to act is born in receptivity. When we come into the state of being that is deep receptivity, the impulse for compassionate action emerges spontaneously. Bernie Glassman, author and founder of Zen Peacemakers, writes, "When we bear witness, when we become the situation, whether it's homelessness, poverty, illness, violence, death, the right action arises by itself. We don't have to worry about what to do. We don't have to figure out solutions ahead of time. Peacemaking is the function of bearing witness. Once we listen with our entire body and mind, loving action arises." And then I finish by saying, "I'm reminded of a teaching from my root tradition that continues to be full of significance for me. The angel Gabriel has just announced to the Virgin Mary that she's to give birth to a child who will be the Messiah for whom Israel is waiting. I imagine Mary pausing, I imagine her head saying, that's impossible. And her heart saying, what if? I imagine her confusion. And I imagine the moment that she chooses to trust as she opens to the silence between the words. And I hear her reply, let what you've said be done unto me. In consciously opening to the flow of what is, the miraculous happens. Reading that reminds me of where I wrote this little book, which was by the creek at La Casa de Maria. So I was so delighted to see Stephanie here this morning. Lovely to see you, Stephanie. And so excited to hear of kind of some plans to continue the rebuilding at La Casa de Maria. We're so looking forward to coming back there before too long, hopefully. The healing of La Casa de Maria. Yeah. So Richard Rohr goes on towards the end of the chapter. He says, one recent holy man who came to visit me put it this way. He said, we must listen to what's supporting us. We must listen to what's encouraging us. We must listen to what's urging us. And I think he's talking about inner support, inner encouragement, inner urging. We must listen to what's alive in us. And I would echo this by saying we must find what makes us feel awake, alive, connected, what brings us peace of heart, what makes others, especially the poorest and the weakest, happy and free. And we must align our actions with this. This is what brings us into sacred wholeness. So that's kind of the first little part, my kind of responding to the chapter. In the second part, I'm going to talk a little bit more about my own personal kind of explorations on the nature of sacred wholeness that I'd like to share with you some of. But before we do that, I've got just a little invitation, and that is for each of you just to turn to your partner at your table and say, you may know your partner very well, or it may be the first time you've sat next to this person, and just say, I'm so-and-so, saying what your name is, and what opens my heart and brings me into a sense of being awake, alive, and connected is, I'm so-and-so, and what opens my heart and makes me feel awake, alive, connected is, and finish that sentence. Okay? So turn to your neighbor. Simple. Just want to make sure everybody's got a chance to share. So if you haven't already swapped over, just swap over to finish up and swap over to the next person. If anybody hasn't had a chance to share, now's the last minute, so please take an opportunity to do so. Okay, thank you for taking part in that. And I gather from Judith that you normally take a break around now, so maybe now is a good time to break. And then, how long, Judith? Will you ring a bell when people come back together? Or okay, very good.